The court will proceed to the third case of the day, Jose Barraza-Ibarra v. Gonzalez. Mr. Berg.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Roy F. Berg, and I represent the petitioner on the next case before you this morning, Mr. Jose Luis Barraza-Ibarra. Mr. Barraza has lived in the United States since 1981, a little over 26 years. Both of his parents are naturalized United States citizens. His wife is a native-born U.S. citizen, as are the four children that they are raising together. Mr. Barraza seeks relief pursuant to Section 212C of the Immigration and Nationality Act, as applied to him by a 2001 Supreme Court decision, INS versus St. Cyr. His initial request for 212C relief was denied by Judge Patron here in Chicago in 1999. And when Judge Patron concluded that he was statutorily ineligible for that relief pursuant to 1996 enactments by Congress. While the case was on appeal before the board, the Supreme Court decided the INS versus St. Cyr case and remanded the case back to the Chicago Immigration Court for a hearing on 212C. Now, since Judge Patron had retired in the interim, the case was taken over by Judge Cuevas, sitting here in Chicago, who initially set the case for hearing in 2004. However, just before that hearing, the government submitted a number of documents, even though the local rule requires that documents be submitted 10 days before the hearing. They submitted those documents literally the day before the hearing to the court. Judge Cuevas decided to continue the case later in 2004 and ultimately set it for hearing in 2005. In the interim, the board issued its decision, Matter of Blake, in which it held that a person with this type of conviction could not get a 212C, waiver. So I think the main questions that you're faced with today in this case is, first and foremost, did the board correctly decide Blake? We submit that it did not correctly decide Blake, and it is wrong. Secondly, does your decision in Villari that you issued in January of this year preclude you from overturning Blake or ruling that Blake was not correctly decided? We submit that Villari is distinguishable, and that Villari is distinguishable, and that you can still grant this gentleman a hearing on 212C relief. Next, should this court adopt the Second Circuit's canon, and should it adopt the Second Circuit's decision from June 1st of 2007, Blake versus Carboni? And we believe that this court can and should adopt the reasoning of the Second Circuit in Blake versus Carboni. It was the Second Circuit that first came up with the Francis case, or first decided the Francis case in the 70s, that held that 212C is available to individuals that are in deportation proceedings, even though they have not left the United States or are not seeking to return or adjust their status. We would submit that this court, in a decision I believe written by you, Judge Flom, on June 21st of this year, joined by Judge Mannion and Judge Rovner, I believe that case is Gutierrez-Almanzon versus Gonzalez, in a footnote held that the board might want to revisit the issue of its decision in the matter of Blake in light of the Second Circuit's decision in Blake versus Carboni. Lastly, can he adjust his status or readjust, it's probably a better term, to permanent residence based on his wife's petition? We believe he can, but we don't believe that's really necessary. Under matter of Azarum, a person can readjust based, even though he is in deportation proceedings. But we, in order to get a readjustment under Azarum, you also have to have a 212C waiver. If a 212C waiver is granted, he doesn't need to readjust through his wife. Now, as far as Blake being wrongly decided, the respondent contends that Blake was not a radical departure from prior board precedent. We respectfully disagree. The board in 1991, in a case called Matter of Meza, held that a person convicted of an aggravated felony in deportation proceedings could obtain a 212C waiver, even though the term aggravated felony is not a ground of inadmissibility under 212. In Blake, the board seems to have ignored Meza, or simply is saying that a person in the respondent's position, or excuse me, the petitioner's position, cannot seek a 212C waiver. We believe that Blake is wrongly decided and clearly violates equal protection. Now, next, is Valerie or Villari distinguishable, and can you hold that Blake is wrong? Well, we submit that Valerie is clearly distinguishable. This court in Villari stated that the petitioner did not, I believe this is at page 761 of your decision, did not directly challenge the BIA's conclusion in Blake that sexual abuse of a minor did not have a statutory counterpart in 212A. The court criticized the two arguments that the petitioner in Villari made, calling one fuzzy at best and the second likewise difficult to make out. The court rejected the two arguments, the only two arguments raised by the petitioner in Villari, that Blake had an impermissible retroactive effect, and second, that it violated equal protection, arguing that a 212C waiver should be available to all deportable aliens. Well, the court went on to say that as to the first impermissible retroactivity argument, that Villari seems to be arguing the decision in St. Cyr gives rise to a vested right to 212C. We are not contending that Mr. Barraza has a vested right to 212C, only a hearing on that, something that he's been precluded from since 1999, a hearing at which an immigration judge would have to balance, as this court said in Akinemi, the positives and the negatives, the good factors and the bad factors. That has never been done in this case. Following the St. Cyr decision, when the board remanded it back to the immigration judge, the government did not file a motion to reconsider. It did not say to the board in 2001, no, we disagree with your remand because he's not eligible, because it's not an identical comparable ground. DHS did not raise it in front of Judge Cuevas between 2001 and 2005 when Blake came up. They never raised that argument at all, that he was statutorily ineligible because of the particular ground of deportability. Now, the second argument made by the petitioner Villari was equal protection. The court noted that the petitioner seemed to be suggesting that the reasoning in Francis requires that a 212C waiver be extended, or the possibility for one be extended, to all people facing deportation for convictions obtained by a guilty plea prior to 212C's repeal. In the discussion in Villari, this court italicized the word all twice to bring attention to that. We are not saying that all deportable aliens have the right to a 212C hearing. This court has held long ago in the Leal case cited in Villari that a permanent resident who enters the United States without inspection cannot get a 212C waiver to waive that ground of deportability, because entry without inspection is a ground of deportability, not a ground of inadmissibility. Also, a person convicted of a firearm offense cannot get a 212C waiver. That's been the case law for a long time. The Attorney General reasserted that in 1991 in the Hernandez-Casillas case. In other words, since a firearm offense is a ground of deportability and not at all a ground of inadmissibility, 212C cannot be used to waive that. This court can and should follow Blake versus Carboni. There's nothing in the Villari decision that contradicts Blake versus Carboni. In fact, in the discussion section of Blake versus Carboni, the Second Circuit's decision from June 1st of this year, the court in part one and part two of its discussion basically rewrites Villari. It says that it was not impermissibly retroactive to apply Blake to that those particular four petitioners in that decision. And secondly, that it did not violate equal protection to say that not all persons can get 212C relief. The focus, as the Second Circuit pointed out, as it pointed out first in Francis and all the courts that have followed Francis, should be on the act or the conviction of the alien, not on the specific grounds, but on the act. In other words, would that same person, for that same event, whether it be a crime or an action, would that person be inadmissible for that same thing? And if he or she would be, then that should be able to get a 212C waiver as for that particular action. As far as adjustment of status under Azarin, I believe the respondent and the board has conceded that he could have adjusted status based on the approved petition that was filed while the case was on appeal the first time in 2000. However, Azarin, and they said, we could not get it because it should have been asked for when he was back in front of Judge Cuevas between 2001 and 2005. Well, that would have required the prior attorney, Mr. Atkinson, to have the clairvoyance and the prescience to be able to predict the future, that the board was going to reverse or to issue this decision, matter of Blake. That was such a radical departure from matter of Mesa. So therefore, we believe he can adjust status, as the board has done in other cases. I attached a decision to my brief, the Castro case, in which they did that, in which a petition was filed by his United States citizen son and approved. And now we're back in front of the immigration court on that very case. But we don't believe he has to readjust because Blake is wrongly decided. Since Blake is wrongly decided, he can get a 212C waiver. And since he can get a 212C waiver, he doesn't need to seek readjustment based on that approved petition. Now, one of the arguments the Second Circuit said at the very end of its decision in Blake versus Carboni is it did not have to decide or address the rule of leniency and whether it applies. Well, I believe the rule of leniency does clearly apply, that these statutes are to be interpreted so as to favor these vulnerable people before you, so as to favor the alien, so as to favor the immigrant. Also, they should be interpreted so as not to tear apart families, and that's what the government seeks to do, to tear a man apart from his wife, his mother, and the four United States citizen children. I would ask to reserve any additional time I have for rebuttal, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Mr. Zanfardino.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Richard Zanfardino for the respondent. This Court's decision in Valair has settled the issue of statutory counterparts. Mr. Berg's arguments regarding this panel somehow overruling another panel's decision should be rejected. The petitioner is attempting to relitigate cases that have been litigated throughout the years. This is a longstanding protocol of thinking regarding statutory counterpart. You have a track of inadmissibility regarding aliens who are out of the country seeking to come in or seeking a benefit from the government. You have deportability, aliens who are, have been admitted or inspected and who the government wishes to deport. Section 212C, by its very text, applies to inadmissibility. Now, years ago, we had the Francis decision in the Second Circuit that decided to allow both classes of aliens to seek that form of relief. The board acquiesced to the Second Circuit because the Second Circuit at the time had been the vanguard on that particular issue and applied it nationwide. But years passed, and as courts, including Valair and including this court in Leal Rodriguez, have recognized, the statutory counterpart test remained in the sense that an alien who was deportable and sought a waiver of inadmissibility, if the inadmissible alien couldn't have the waiver either, there was no violation of Francis, and there was no need to, there was no ability to grant 212C waiver. Petitioner cites Your Honor's opinion in Gutierrez-Almazan, the footnote regarding the Blake decision. We would first point out, of course, that one footnote does not overrule another panel's decision, and the footnote merely stated the obvious. It's interesting that the decision in Gutierrez-Almazan stated that the board merely stated the obvious. The board had denied a motion in that case saying that sufficient basis was not met simply by pronouncing they were not persuaded. That's the same thing that happened in the footnote, which is the footnote points out that while the case is back before the board is theoretically free to look at the Blake decision and decide that 30-plus years of statutory counterpart tests were wrong, decide that the First Circuit, the Third Circuit, the Fifth Circuit, this circuit, the Eighth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit were wrong. The board is, in theory, free to do that. The likelihood, we would suggest, is molecular. It's very low. The Blake decision in the Second Circuit was also looked at by the Ninth Circuit in Abebe and the Eighth Circuit in Voot and rejected. The Blake decision itself focuses on an alien's conduct, not an alien's whether or not there are comparable grounds of inadmissibility versus removability. And Abebe in particular pointed that out in that decision. Blake also had to contend with Francis, which still was good law. The motion itself, we would point out to the court, it's really a situation of equity, not law. What you have before this court is a criminal alien, an alien convicted of a sexual abuse of a minor. Congress has mandated that aliens convicted of certain crimes may not come to this court to seek relief. Yet, when he approached the board in his, each of his two motions, he only asserted equitable bases for reopening or reconsideration. But even assuming that he had, did raise a question of law, the board did not abuse its discretion, which is the standard of review, that they thought instead of just reacted. The board recognized that petitioner had had an approved visa petition since March of 2001 and appeared in immigration court five different times, never once filed a motion to remand or reopen with either the board or the immigration judge for 5 years and 8 months past the date of his approval of the visa petition. An argument waived is an argument abandoned regarding briefs. And we would suggest to the court as well that for a litigant to be aware of relief and forego it should meet the same result. That's also buttressed by the regulations of the board itself. The board regulations require, in order to reopen, that evidence be new and unavailable previously. When the alien appeared with his motion in 2006, an approved visa petition filed back in March of 2001 was not new. It was not unavailable. Petitioner simply looked at, made decisions, and decided not to pursue that application. To suggest that he had no need to because the statutory counterpart test was somehow a radical departure misunderstands the law, particularly where even the recent Vu decision pointed out that the statutory counterpart test, as far back as 1993, 3 years after his conviction, was well settled. A well-settled process and protocol of thinking. Regarding the motion, again, there's no abuse of discretion on the part of the board to require litigants to come forth with their requests early, when they have the evidence, when it is new and unavailable.
You know, I guess there are no appeals for someone who, we'll say, benefited from the 212C. So we don't really know what a counterpart, a valid counterpart is. We know what it isn't, but we don't know what it is.
We have one case from the board, Your Honor, regarding drug trafficking that does say that this is a statutory counterpart. There is an inadmissibility ground regarding the trafficking of drugs and an aggravated felony definition, 101A43B, regarding drug trafficking. So the board has pronounced there that there's a statutory counterpart. The problem with the statutory counterpart test in terms of finding ones that match is that oftentimes that's where a litigant is getting their day in court. And so there's less of a reason to come forth and argue that you were deprived of something.
You mean when there is a counterpart?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, I guess that's right. When we talk about moral turpitude, you know, that's a broad term, but we require something much more precise in order to be a counterpart.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. It needs to be more than just focusing on their conduct. The fact that you might be able to characterize their conduct as involving moral turpitude is not a matter of matching statutory counterpart grounds, which this Court has recognized in Leal and Valair. Petitioner's motions weren't just 11th hour. They weren't 11th hour and 59 minute. That ship had sailed. Petitioner was free to seek adjustment of status for years. There was well-settled precedent explaining the statutory counterpart test, and he did not act on that. We did make the argument in our brief that because petitioner's motions sounded in equity and not law, that once this court follows its decision in Valair, two remaining petitions for review regarding the two motions would deprive this court of jurisdiction because he had not raised any legal question. The fact that petitioner can cite the Due Process Clause of the Constitution should not allow a litigant to escape the Real ID's, Congress's use of Real ID to restrict litigants' rights to come to court. But again, even if he did raise an argument of a question of law, we would argue there was no abuse of discretion, merely a recognition on the part of the board that he had numerous opportunities to seek relief and did not present that. Finally, regarding petitioner's due process claim, we'd also remind the court that there is no due process violation in discretionary forms of relief under the Immigration Nationality Act under this court's precedents in Dondon v. Ashcroft and Dave versus Ashcroft. With that, unless there are any further questions, we'll submit in our brief.
I have one observation. There are three cases involving this today.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're aware of that, with three different people arguing them. Is that purposeful?
No, Your Honor, and unfortunately the office is quite large now, and we're trying to do a better job of grouping cases for each attorney. But this case was particularly complex, at least in terms of a factual pattern. So, and in fact, I actually requested to have this case from the very first petition for review because there were so many petitions and motions flying back and forth, including the stay motion.
That's just an observation.
I don't want to say guarded optimism, but your optimism that Blake versus Carbone won't receive any favorable BIA consideration. Is there some tea leaves we're missing that in a BIA decision, or is just that the number of circuits that have not joined the second is what gives you the optimism that the BIA wouldn't revisit?
It tends to be more empirical in terms of looking at the landscape, Your Honor, with the number of circuits, and also the board itself, having employed the statutory counterpart test for so long.
Yeah, I understand.
Again, the Blake decision in the Second Circuit.
Well, I mean, the Second and the Ninth have carried a fair load in this area, and then obviously the Second issued its decision, and I see Judge was it Barzan or I think it was Judge Berzon, concurred, felt constrained, I guess, because of the earlier case. So you just think it's the BIA will likely look to the number of circuits that have not joined.
Correct. And this is not the same situation as we had in Francis, where the Second Circuit was essentially the first circuit to kind of come out and make...
I understand the intent of the Second was to cause a serious revisiting of the area. Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor, but there's no official
pronouncement. BIA hasn't issued any opinion in any other case yet, has it, that's commented on?
On the Blake decision? No published decision, no, Your Honor.
You would anticipate that probably...
Unpublished?
Unpublished regarding Blake? I couldn't speak to whether or not they've come out with an unpublished. They do so many, obviously, per day, but... And I can't anticipate what reaction they will have to the Blake decision.
No, I understand. It would be unfair of me to ask you that, but do you think that it would be forthcoming in the next 90, 120 days, just from the calendar of the BIA, that they would might speak to Blake?
I think Murphy's Law would dictate that whatever answer I gave would be twice as much or half as much on that, Your Honor. And I think that this court is well within its power, however, to follow Valair. And
no, I appreciate that. I just the reason the footnote was there was to see whether the agency was going to, you know, favor us with some
pronouncement about Blake. Yes, sir. And the board may very well do that. They may very well acquiesce, especially because the Second Circuit has come along a little bit late compared to other circuits that have all fallen in behind the statutory counterpart test.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Berg.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Shalom, as you correctly noted, there was a concurrence in the Ninth Circuit case, I believe, by Judge Berzon. Also in the Eighth Circuit case that counsel was kind enough to send to us, the View case, there was also a concurrence in there by Judge Bai, stating that he agreed with the reasoning in Blake versus Carbone. However, his panel was bound by the prior Soriano decision, an Eighth Circuit decision from 2006. As far as this 5.5-year period or these 5 appearances in front of the immigration court during which counsel is contending that Mr. Barraza or his prior counsel could have sought adjustment of status, I think we have to look at what the board did. The board sent it back for 212C. While the case was on appeal, the attorney had said, yes, we're filing an I-130 petition, but the board didn't send it back and didn't address that I-130 petition. It sent it back for 212C. The government could have filed a motion to reconsider within 30 days of that board decision in 2001, but did not do so. At no time between the remand in 2001 and when Blake was decided in May 2005 did the government contend to Judge Cuevas that Mr. Barraza was not statutorily eligible because of a comparable ground test or the specific language of his conviction. We submit, Your Honor, that the Blake versus Carbone decision is correctly decided. This court can follow it. this court's Valari decision. Yes.
What about Valari? What?
Valari, as we said earlier, I think this court did not address the two arguments that were raised in Valari. And I believe it was Judge Sykes, in her opinion, said that Mr. Valari does not raise the statutory accountability argument. He didn't raise it. Now, if you look at Blake versus Carboni and you read Valari side by side, Judge, the first parts of those decisions are very similar. This court in Valari rejected the retroactivity argument. Blake versus Carboni, part one, discussion, rejects retroactivity. Part two, rejects the equal protection when it says that it has to apply to all. This court, in the opinion, the word all is italicized twice. Not all deportable aliens can get a 212C waiver, even if they're deportable because of a conviction to which they pled guilty. So I don't believe that this court in Valari is precluded from ruling that Blake versus Carboni is correct law. Now, it's interesting that when Blake versus in the Second Circuit talks about the other circuits that have ruled the other way, it doesn't cite this court's opinion, because I don't believe this court's opinion is contrary to Part 3 of Blake versus Carboni. I would ask Your Honors, therefore, to grant the petition, and we thank you for your consideration.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.